show on the Sundance TV channel called Close Up with the Hollywood Reporter, in which one of the editors of that trade publication sits down with a half dozen drama actors or actresses or comedy actresses or actors or maybe the people who run these TV shows, when sometimes it's about the movies, and they get into a discussion of how they do what they do. I found some of the conversations fascinating. There was one with Jessica Lange and Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon, among a bunch of drama actresses. Comedy actors like Kamal Nanjiani and Kevin Bacon and Ted Danson were in there. Another one with Catherine Hahn and Pamela Adlon and Minnie Driver. And in fact, before I get to our guest, who is Lacey Rose, the TV editor of The Hollywood Reporter, I want to play you a clip from one of the recent shows. This is Minnie Driver talking about how difficult it is to be as tall as she is. She's 5'10", and working with actors who are not quite up to her height.
On many movies I've done with actors who are mostly short, I mean, most actors are short, they're mostly not tall, and certainly the ones I've worked with, they would dig me a ditch. They would dig you a hole to do a kissing scene
so that you could be there.
So you'd be in there and down with the mud and the dirt and below. And I remember just voicing early on, wouldn't it be just a bit easier if maybe he stood on a half apple or a whole apple?
Yes.
Wow. And dig me a ditch. So you're like,
I have never felt sorry for tall people until just
this moment. It was really
moment.
Embarrassing and awful. And I remember saying to, it happened twice. I remember on both occasions saying to the actor, isn't it weird for you? And they were like, no. It's fine. It's great because now we're at the same height.
Oh, God.
That's sad.
That was embarrassing.
Yes. Sad.
That is Minnie Driver on the Sundance TV series Close Up with the Hollywood Reporter, which is hosted by my guest today, Lacey Rose, who's the television editor of the Hollywood Reporter. Hi, Lacey. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I got to tell you, I am a fan of this show. I've been watching it. You're into your third season now. And whether it's you doing the TV stuff and the build up to the Emmys or the other people who do the movie side of it in the build up to the Academy Awards, I love hearing these actors and showrunners talking about the process of their creative works.
Thank you. It's it is really interesting. I like watching these actors and actresses and showrunners talk to each other more than anything else. People who they haven't worked with before about their respective processes. That to me is the most interesting part because often they approach things very differently and are surprised by how other people at the table do.
Yeah, it's interesting to me to see them warm up. After you've asked the questions, they kind of warm up to each other, whether they knew each other beforehand or not. They realize, oh, this is an open conversation. It's not just an interview.
Mm-hmm. I think that's exactly right. I mean, and part of that is on me to make sure I start the conversation with the kinds of questions that would allow them to open up. I mean, oftentimes I throw out one. It's not necessarily always edited this way, but often I start with an icebreaker. You know, the time in your career where you were most embarrassed as a performer, or the sort of the craziest thing you did to land a job, the things that are going to sort of put them all in a place where they don't have to take themselves and the craft so seriously. They can have a little fun with it. And I think that often puts them at ease, and the conversation sort of quickly changes as a result.
There was one story that Ewan McGregor told recently when you were talking to the drama actors, six of them sitting around the table there. And he talked, you asked him, is it more fun to play a loser? And he enthusiastically said yes, didn't he?
Yep. And I think you often see that. You know, it's the same. They like to play, I think, on the conversation with the drama actresses. I asked a question about whether, you know, how they feel about approaching unlikable characters. And I think what you heard from, you know, from Elizabeth Moss and some of the other folks at that table is, yeah, it's a whole lot more fun. You know, to play the bad guy or to play the loser, the one who, I mean, it's in some ways much easier to play the sort of happy good guy, but not nearly as much fun and not nearly as challenging for an actor or an actress.
Well, in a lot of these cases, playing, if not the loser, at least the villain of the piece, they're the ones who drive it. I mean, a great superhero or super spy movies or any kind of thing like that, they need a great villain. Or you had Billy Bob Thornton on one of your roundtables, and he was talking about playing Lorne Malvo on Fargo. That's the character that we turned back in to watch week after week, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And I think as an actor, I mean, there's sort of more range within those roles. You know, they get to sort of take those types of characters in different directions. And I think on some level, they can be more rewarding for these actors. At least that seems to be a recurring theme in the conversations we've had as part of this series.
You know, one of the things that I noticed in the episodes that you've done with the actresses, both comedy and drama, is the recurring theme to them is still the problem of sexism in hiring, and particularly in the audition process. You think? I think it was Emmy Rossum who told the bikini story. Would you share that?
Oh yes, the bikini story. Yes, Emmy was sort of most vocal on this issue, and she talked about, you know, she'd already been having her success on Shameless and in other roles, and, you know, she was, you know, eager to parlay that success into film roles, and she was approached, or her agents were approached, by a director who wanted her to, you know, audition for this movie, which she was extremely excited about. And then all of a sudden she learned what they wanted from her, and it was to come to the audition in a bikini, which initially, I mean, her, she was sort of shocked and appalled, and then she was trying to rationalize it, and she sort of asked, you know, does the role require me to wear a bikini? And the answer was, nope. And she was horrified, and as one should be. But I think the takeaway was, this isn't uncommon, and the fact that she even sort of had that moment of trying to rationalize it was incredibly problematic. And what is wrong with what has been going on?
It's stunning to me that there are guys who are still getting away with that.
It's stunning to her, stunning to every other woman at that table. Yeah, but I think her point was, I should share this, because the more people who are stunned, the more likely it is to have somebody stand up and say, you know what, this has got to stop. That guy shouldn't get his next job or the job after.
And yet, in light of that, we still have to keep in mind that there are a lot of women who are getting great roles on television now, and with the huge number of outlets that are available with all the streaming services and the cable channels, there are a lot more opportunities for women to get roles. Are they turning to TV like Reese Witherspoon and Nicole Kidman because there's a dearth of that opportunity in the movies and TV gives them the chance to do more things?
Absolutely. I mean, and specifically, I mean, Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon both talked, I mean, about just this, that, I mean, Nicole is much more interested in doing TV now than she is in the film world, and Reese as well. And a part of that is, you know, they can take the roles in the film world, but more often than not, particularly on the sort of bigger films, it's the wives, and the mother, and the mothers, and I mean, these sort of lesser roles where they can take television shows and be the star and have these sort of juicy parts, and the stories unfold not over an hour and a half or 2 hours as they do in theaters, but rather over, you know, 10, 12 episodes. So they have a chance and to have the kind of range that you don't get on the film screen.
I want to play another piece of audio from one of the episodes of Close Up with the Hollywood Reporter that you did with Elizabeth Moss, who coincidentally is on the cover of the Hollywood Reporter print edition this week as the queen of peak TV. Before I get to the audio, what does that mean, the queen of peak TV?
Well, I wrote the article on her, so I chose those words, and I did it because this is a woman who, if you look at her career, she went from, and she started on The West Wing, but more recently it was Mad Men, Top of the Lake, and Handmaid's Tale, and these are all shows in an era where there are, you know, 400, 500, approaching 600 scripted television shows. These are sort of prestige shows that were able to cut through, that were able to sort of become darlings at a time where so much of what is on gets lost. So the fact that the recurring theme in all three shows is Elizabeth Moss felt like it was appropriate to then anoint her as the queen of this era.
Yeah, and peak TV, because there are hundreds and hundreds of shows being produced in an industry that years ago was making the count more like in the dozens.
Well, yes, an industry that used to have three and then four networks with the inclusion of Vox, now has, you know, over 100 channels and over 500 original scripted television shows.
Okay, so before I play this clip of Elizabeth Moss on Close Up with the Hollywood Reporter, it needs a little bit of setup, and it's her talking about the rape scenes on the Handmaid's Tale, which is a series that's on Hulu, which I don't subscribe to, so I haven't seen it. Also, it takes place in a dystopian era, and I don't do dystopia. Maybe you can set it up a little bit more, and then I'll roll right into the clip.
Yeah, you know, one of the questions I asked, and I think I asked it specifically to her, but it was relevant to Nicole Kidman in her role on Big Little Lies as well. But the question was, how do you sort of emotionally prepare for these types of scenes? And in her case, I mean, you mentioned it's a dystopian universe that they're living in, and it very much is, and that what that entails is quite harrowing at times. So how do you prepare for that? And then how do you shake it? How do you get out of that world as an actress? When a director yells cut, how are you able to shake that and go back to being a normal person?
Quite simply, I just sort of thought, what would one do in this situation? You know, it sounds sort of so over simple, perhaps, but I just was like, if you were being assaulted, sexually assaulted on a regular basis, and you knew there was nothing you could do about it, what would you do? You know, there's no escape, and you can't fight back. And so I thought, well, she would probably try not to be there. You have to. How else do you deal with such a thing if you don't go somewhere else? You can't be there. You can't experience it. That you wouldn't make it, you know? So, which happens to women in that world. They don't make it. So I just thought, okay, well, I just have to go somewhere else. And that's what I was trying to do, was just show that she wasn't there. And in the shooting of it, it was really important for us to have it be extremely clinical, mechanical. There's nothing sexual remotely about it.
That is Elizabeth Moss answering a question from Lacey Rose, who's the host of Close Up with the Hollywood Reporter, a roundtable discussion with the actresses who make TV's most exciting drama. Isn't that how you've always put it, Lacey?
It is, yeah. I mean, I think that's precisely what it is.
Yeah. You also did a roundtable with comedy actors, and one of them is Kumail Nanjiani, who is getting great raves for what I think is my favorite and best movie of the year 2017, and that is The Big Sick. But you had him on there because he's one of the stars of HBO's Silicon Valley. And you asked him, you know, what's one of the things that helps you decide whether a joke or a line stays in? And he said, essentially, if it feels funny, it's successful. If not, it's a failure. And that's his criteria. But that's different than sitcom people. They have to go based on whether the audience laughs. Isn't that one of the big disparities between single cam and multicam sitcoms?
Absolutely. I mean, yes, in a single camera comedy, which is what Silicon Valley is, which means you are not filming in front of a studio audience, so they're not multiple cameras and a studio audience, yeah, you have to go with your gut. What do you and the other actors and first the writers in the room think is funny? Whereas a multicam sitcom, you know whether something is hitting the minute it's acted out, and they'll often sort of try another take if it bombs in that room. It's a little more reliant on the gut of the showrunner and then the actor performing it.
Must be frustrating for some of these single cam people to do something they think is funny, but don't know if it's actually funny to the viewers until literally months later.
I think that that's right, but I think that we talked about the sort of peak TV era that we are in. I mean, there are so many channels, there's so many places to find shows that I think what it does allow is things to be a little more niche. These shows don't have to be funny for everybody in the way that they used to. There are options. You can find the show that is funny for you. So I think that the sort of definition of what's funny there can be multiple answers to that, and there can be multiple places to find your definition of funny in today's era.
The next two episodes are going to air on Sunday mornings on Sundance TV. You get close up with the comedy and drama showrunners. Those are each separate shows coming up. And I know in the comedy one, you talk a little bit about showrunner freedom. I'm curious, though, if you're working for a Netflix or a Hulu or an Amazon or one of the lesser known cable channels, perhaps, and you do get a deal to make a show, do you still get what used to be called network notes?
It depends where and it depends to what degree. What you're not getting are the sort of traditional broadcast network layers upon layers of notes where, you know, you have these executives who have been doing this for a very long time and there's a certain way that, you know, it's supposed to work. You're not hearing those kinds of things. This is the way we do it. This is what audiences find funny. And by the way, to the point that I had just made, when you're making something on a Netflix or an Amazon or an FX, you don't have to appeal to everybody. So yep. you do have the freedom to sort of figure out what you think is going to be compelling, what you think is going to be funny. You know, they can be quirky. They can be, you know, a little different, a little sort of weirder in some ways, and that's appreciated on those channels in the way it isn't on an ABC or an NBC.
And you don't have to worry about complaints from the standards and practices censors, right?
That is also true, yes. So you'll obviously get more sexuality, more profanity. Yeah, you have those freedoms as well.
How do CBS, NBC, Fox, ABC, the traditional broadcast networks, how do they compete in a world where these creative types get so much freedom elsewhere? Why would they ever come under the auspices of one of these big networks that have been around for 70, 100 years, whatever the number is? Why would they go there?
I mean, look, I think that is the real question and the real challenge, particularly on the trauma side that you're seeing. And I think they are having a tremendous amount of trouble finding showrunners that want to tell their stories, particularly in the hour format. On the drama side, I think there's a one-word answer, particularly on the comedy side, and that is money. The opportunity to make a tremendous amount of money is still significantly greater on a CBS. Just ask the man who created The Big Bang Theory or Two and a Half Men or NCIS, and their bank accounts will answer that question for you.
Are there shows that go on Netflix and Amazon that are later syndicated? No, right?
Not yet. I mean, remember, we're still in the very, very early stages of these streaming network shows, and there is a question. I mean, there are a handful that have then aired on a traditional cable network. I think that will start to change, but we don't really know what the sort of, like they call it in this world, the back end, the sort of the second life, the second window for these shows. We don't know what that will ultimately look like, because right now, these are shows that are made available anytime you want it. You can find it there. So what is the value in that sort of 4 years later in that second window? There have been a handful of examples of shows that have, you know, gone to cable networks, but those were, you know, from the very, very beginning and when they were sort of figuring out the sort of deal-making terms. But I think that's going to be a question that is being debated, will continue to be debated, and we'll see what the afterlife for these streaming shows will be.
Speaking of the afterlife, are any of them ever going to get to the long-term notoriety of, well, I'll pick a show that's in reruns on the same channel that you're on. MASH airs on the Sundance Channel, I don't know, multiple times a week. Here's a show that debuted on TV more than 45 years ago and is still rerunning on television and making money for somebody.
The production company.
Yeah. I wonder.
Absolutely.
I wonder if a show like 30 Rock. Well, that was a network show too. But some of the other stuff that's been done on Netflix or Hulu or whatever. Although Hulu just actually bought the MASH library.
Exactly. I mean, yes, and you hear. I mean, you talk to the creators of Friends, and that found a new life on Netflix. And you know, I think if you went out and polled, a bunch of middle schoolers, they're probably at least half of them think that is a current show on Netflix. Have no idea of the entire life that it lived, on NBC for all those years.
So these
shows are finding new lives, and presumably that will only continue.
So that's where the legacy will really be. You won't have to set your DVR to record something.
Oh, no.
You'll decide, hey, it's Thursday at 9:30 at night, and I want to see an episode of whatever show I want, and that's what Netflix and Amazon can afford to do.
That is the purpose that they serve. Yes, I think you're already very much seeing that.
Let me ask you about something else I learned from your show. I used to play the Kevin Bacon game on my radio show years ago. I was very, very good at doing the 6 degrees of connecting people to Kevin Bacon. But it wasn't until you interviewed him on one of your roundtables that I learned he hates that game.
Well, he claimed he was getting a little more comfortable, but at the beginning, when that game came about, yes, he said it was something that he hated. And part of that was because he was trying to, you know, here he was a young guy, and he was trying to be a serious actor, and all of a sudden there was a parlor game about him. And he didn't want to be a parlor game. So yes, he talked about, you know, Jon Stewart, one of his previous shows, you know, wanted to have him come on, but the two guys that, you know, invented the game. And he was like, oh, absolutely not. But I think he did. And then he sort of joked around about, you know, I think one of the other actors on the roundtable asked if he would, you know, he should cash in on it. He should find a way to sort of parlay that into some extra revenue. And he joked and said, you know, he had tried an app, he had tried a couple things, and you know, wasn't successful in that realm. But he, I think he, you know, as he has gotten older and he is, you know, he's had tremendous success, he's gotten more comfortable with the 6 degrees game.
I think it was Ted Danson on that same show who said he wished that there was a Ted Danson game.
I think that's probably right. Yeah, they had a lot of fun talking about sort of fame and you know, whether that, you know, how they sort of dealt with it. I mean, I think one of the other things that I really found fascinating was Kevin Bacon also talked about how he, you know, wanted to know what life would be like as someone who wasn't famous, and he had a prosthetic mask made, and he went to the Grove, which is a real Hollywood sort of mall here, and, you know, walked around with that, and nobody recognized him. And so as a result, he was, you know, people were sort of pushing through a line and treated him as anyone else and sort of shoved him out of the way. And his takeaway was he didn't like not being famous. And the mask was never worn again.
Yeah, there's no Kevin Bacon in a mask game.
No, there's not. No, precisely. And you don't get the free coffee or book or whatever it was at the end, and instead you get sort of shoved out of the way and have to wait in line like everybody else. So yes, it wasn't quite as appealing as perhaps he thought it was going in.
Lacey Rose is the host of Close Up with the Hollywood Reporter. She works there as the television editor, and the show airs Sunday mornings on Sundance TV. I set my DVR to record every episode of it now in its third season. If you've missed the previous episodes, they're all archived on Sundance.tv. Congratulations on the continuing success of the show, Lacey, and thanks for joining me today.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.